You are listening to the Apex Hour, hosted by Ryan Paul on KSUU Thunder 91.1. This show allows more personal time with our guests, allowing them to give us their stories and opinions. We will also give you new music to listen to, hoping you enjoy some new sounds and genres. Welcome to this episode of the Apex Hour.
Welcome to the Apex Radio Hour. I'm producer Faith Christensen. I'm joined with Apex Director and Professor of History, Ryan Paul, and our special guest, Dr. Zani Gorman. I'm turning it over to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. Ms. Gorman, we're so happy to have you here today on the Apex Radio Hour. As a historian of the Navajo Code Talkers of World War II, what I always like to start with is a question, kind of a how we get to now question. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you do what you do?
Okay, sure. Well, I am the daughter of Carl Nelson Gorman, and he was one of the original Navajo Code Talkers that was part of the pilot group that the Marine Corps recruited in the spring of 1942. The idea had been brought to them in February. The Marine Corps decided this is a great idea, but they decided to go with a pilot at first to test it. So this first group of men that my dad was with, they were known as the first 29 initially. I grew up with my dad. I grew up with a lot of the other code talkers. Their first honors came in 1969. I was very little at that time. By 1972, they started the Navajo Code Talkers Association. My father was elected to the founding board as a representative of the men who served in the 2nd Marine Division. And that's when he became very active. So a lot of my early memories are actually being dragged to code talker meetings when I was a kid and being bored to death and not knowing what all of these men had done. But, you know, it was a kind of a gradual realization growing up among these men, who they were. And I'm one of those people that loves history, and, you know, the story got under my skin, and I started to pay more attention as the years went by. But it wasn't really until I was in my early 20s that I got very interested in learning more about my dad as the code talker. And because he was with that first group, there was not a lot of information that was available at that time, and even now there's not a lot out there about this first group. So I kind of made that my mission, and I've done over 30 years of research, gone to just about every archive that exists that has code talker stuff in it, looked in out-of-the-way places for stuff, and it's just something that I love, to share their story.
So for those who may not know exactly what a Navajo code talker, who they were, can you briefly explain what they did and why it was necessary?
Yes. The Navajo code talkers were a group of Diné men, as we call ourselves, Diné, that were initially recruited, as I said, in the spring of 1942 with the initial pilot. The Marine Corps was very pleased with what the first group was able to create as a code, which was around 200 terms. And then they sanctified the program in August of 1942, and they started to actively recruit Navajos into the program. And eventually there would be 400-plus Navajos that went through Navajo Code training. They had to go through specific training on base in California to become code talkers. And they were divided between all 6 divisions of the Marine Corps eventually. They served, you know, at the battalion level, the regiment level, various levels within the Marine Corps. And they were needed when the war broke out. The United States was in kind of a little bit of a quandary because the Japanese had already broken our military codes at that point. And so they were looking for secure communications. And the Marine Corps specifically had been, a man had come to them and had suggested this idea of using Navajo specifically. And so that was the thing that got the ball rolling in 1942. So, as I said, they served in every division of the Marine Corps. They served from Guadalcanal all the way through the occupation of Japan. And the Marine Corps credits them tremendously for helping to win the war in the Pacific.
So why was it specifically the Navajo? I mean, were there other branches of code talkers that spoke different Native American languages? Or why do they focus on the Navajo specifically?
Well, the Marine Corps, there's several branches of the service in our country, right? And so In World War I, the U.S. Army had utilized a group of Native men from the Choctaw Nation. And it was just one of those things where they were pinned down, and their commanding officer remembered that they had Choctaws. And so they asked him, hey, are there, because the group had gotten separated. And so they're like, hey, you know, are there some Choctaws in the group that we're separated from? And so they communicated with one another through these Choctaws. And so he wrote up a report following that incident, but it was like a month before the armistice was signed in World War I, and so it wasn't really continued. But the Army definitely, you know, put that in their back pocket, because in World War II, they did recruit several other tribes. And a friend of mine who's a professor out of Missouri State University, Bill Meadows, he's done a lot of work with the U.S. Army Talkers, and he's got a couple of books out about them. And he's done a tremendous job, because there's really not a lot of information that's been available on the Army Talkers, at least, you know, military documentation. And he's really worked particularly with the Comanche group, which was the largest unit in World War II in the U.S. Army. So that's the U.S. Army. The United States Marine Corps had never used a native language up to World War II. So the idea was very new to them. And they, the commandant at that time, Commandant Thomas Holcomb, he was very forward-looking, very innovative. There was a lot of things that were happening right when the war broke out, and here he's the commandant. So he listened to people, and he said, yeah, you know, let's try things out. And so a lot of things happened under his administration that may not have happened with somebody else, because he was willing to kind of take that risk. So the Navajo Code Talkers were one of them. You know, the idea was sent to him, and hey, I saw this demonstration. A general by the name of Clayton B. Vogel had witnessed the first demonstrations in 1942 when a man by the name of Philip Johnston brought them to the Marine Corps. And he was really impressed, and so the commandant was willing to give it a try. And so that's how it started.
So Code Talkers is a Marine Corps term, not a general military term.
Yes, and that's something that I definitely push back. You know, I am biased toward the Marine Corps. But yes, you know, I've done a lot of research. I've looked at thousands of documents from the Marine Corps as well as the U.S. Army. And I have not ever come across that term in U.S. Army documents during the war. But in the Marine Corps documents, you see it. But it was an evolutionary kind of process to get to that point. Because the initial documents, when the first group was recruited, and then probably for about a year, they referred to them as Navajo Indians. And then it was Navajo Talkers and Indian Talkers. And then you start seeing in the latter part of 1944 and into 45, the term Navajo Code Talkers appears in actual Marine Corps memorandums.
So it's interesting to me that most students or people who have been familiar with World War II history or at least passingly familiar with the Navajo Code Talkers, but not so much about the other branches of service and their Native American speakers. I mean, why do you think that is?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think part of it, the Code Talkers, the Navajo Code Talkers, started to get interest very early on. They were first, their first public recognition came in 1969, after the Navajo Code was declassified in 1968, and they were honored by Marines. The first honors came from the 4th Marine Division Association at their 22nd annual reunion that year was held in Chicago. And so they had been working for a whole year, and I think that's probably why it was declassified, because they wanted to honor them, but they needed to declassify it. I don't know for sure. But they honored not just the Code Talkers, but they honored Native Americans that had served in the 4th Marine Division during World War II. So there were members of other tribes, not a whole lot, but there was some other representatives from other tribes. And they struck a bronze medal that each member was given that served in the 4th Marine Division. But with the Code Talkers, they had representatives from all of the other divisions that came. So my dad got to go, and he represented the men from the 2nd Marine Division. So he got a bronze medal.
So, but they only fought in the Pacific.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So the, you know, in our nation has not always been forward-thinking oftentimes in terms of race and certainly in Native American cultures. But I knew that African Americans fought in segregated units. Was there issues of Jim Crow or anything like that with the Code Talkers?
No, and that's an interesting question and one that fascinates me, because looking at the difference between how black men were accepted into the Marine Corps or into the military and the Native Americans accepted into the military, very different. I think with Native people, there's always been an American fascination, right, with American Indians. And even to this day in the military, you find kind of this hyper-masculinized idea of what a Native military personnel is like. You know, they can see in the dark. They can shoot 5,000 yards. And
they're the scouts.
They are the scouts, right? You know, they walk silently in through the brush. And those kinds of images. And you still see that. I mean, war after war after war, you see these kinds of images being talked about. So I think just the fascination with it. I don't know why the Marine Corps story compared to the Army story became more popular or became more, they latched onto it more. That's a really good question. I never really thought about that. I'll have to think about that. But what fascinates me is, you know, like I said, with indigenous men in the military, there's been this hyper-masculinization. And yet with the black soldier, it's just the opposite. They're emasculated. You know, they can't do it. You know, there's these images that they're just not capable of it. And, you know, why such a difference? That's just something that I kind of grapple with when I think about World War II history and the blacks and the indigenous people that served.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. So speaking of that, let's take our first break. And as we have often done on this show, we ask our guests to select some audio songs or audio files that we can play and fill in the break. So the first one that you chose that we've selected is the Marine Corps hymn, actually, sung in Navajo by a Code Talker, Thomas Begay. Can you tell me just a little bit about that?
Yeah. The Marine Corps hymn in Navajo was actually composed by another Code Talker during the war when he was in training at Camp Pendleton in 1943. He composed it. His name was Jimmy King. And Thomas Begay and his wife, she was a beautiful singer, Nina Begay, they used to sing it together a lot when I was growing up. So I grew up hearing the Marine Corps hymn in Navajo. It was really fascinating. And his wife passed away several years ago, and Thomas Begay has continued to sing the song. And by the way, Thomas is one of three surviving Code Talkers out of some 400. We have three Code Talkers that are still living, and he's one of them. He's 98 years old now.
Wow. Okay, so this is the Marine Corps hymn in Navajo by Navajo Code Talker Thomas Begay.
Nohokako ana ta yilant a sokon tatipa ot ato tas ka eke a sokon tatipa tatata ani ne kaela epene he taho zin Tony Tanta he olie the United States Marine.
That was the Marine Corps hymn in Navajo by Navajo Code Talker Thomas Begay. You are listening to the Apex Radio Hour here on KSUU Thunder 91.1. I'll turn it back to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. So we were talking about you mentioned the Navajo Code Talkers, right? So that is, by definition, there is a code that exists. And many people, I mean, I think the predominant myth really is that they just found Navajo was a language that the Japanese would have no basis of understanding, so we'll just get a couple Navajo guys that will speak in Navajo and do that. But that is far from the truth. Can you explain the intricacies of the Navajo Code? And I should say that these 29 guys that come in, they're the ones that develop it, right?
Correct. Yes. So, yes, the first pilot group, they came in and obviously they needed to create a code to test. That was the whole purpose of their recruitment. And so the Marine Corps handed them a list of words of about 200 terms, and it included the alphabet. It included names of countries, types of military equipment like planes, the military organization, ranks of officers, the months. I'm trying to remember because there's like these groupings. And then there's this huge, the most of the code is actually general vocabulary. And so there's this huge general vocabulary that follows those groupings.
So I guess, can I interrupt? So were there words in Navajo for all of these terms already?
No. I mean, obviously we didn't have words for tank and bombs and those kinds of things.
Okay.
So now Navajo is a polysynthetic language, and I'm not a linguist, so I'll do my best to explain this. In all languages, actually, there are these little bits and pieces of words that are called morphemes. And in Navajo, in polysynthetic languages, each morpheme has its own meaning. And so you link these pieces of the words together, these little morphemes together. And so you come up with a quote-unquote word, which is usually technically more of a phrase than an actual word. So what, you know, so it's not atypical for in Navajo to create terms, to create new quote-unquote words. So it was something that I think was maybe a little easier than if they were speaking maybe a language that like English is on the other extreme of the language spectrum. It also has morphemes, but it's put together grammatically very different. So just with that tucked away in the back of your mind, as you said, the popular narrative of the Navajo Code is that you Google it online, you read a book about the code talkers, and it's usually explained in very simple terms. And that is that the Navajo Code, or the Navajos, created a code using substitution, where they substituted words for the English words, or they also developed an alphabet so they could spell out words.
And so substitution would mean we're going to say dog, and instead of saying dog, I would say the Navajo word for cloud.
Exactly. Yeah. In a general sense, that's basically what it is. And it's usually explained by one of the simplest ones in the code to actually see very easily, and that is with the airplanes. You know, so they substituted birds because obviously they flew like planes do. So they made that connection, and they took the characteristics of the birds that they were familiar with, and they coincided them with the equipment and the characteristics of the equipment. So a hummingbird was a fighter plane. You know, if you've ever watched hummingbirds like fight with each other, right? They're vroom, vroom, vroom. An owl was observation plane. A eagle was a transport plane because they're one of the hugest planes. Was it the transport or the other one? Sorry, getting that mixed up. Anyway,
I liked your example. I think you showed me of the dive bomber.
Yes.
Right? It was a chicken hawk, I think is what you had said, right? That it just kind of dives out of the...
Yes.
Very cool.
Yeah. So that's one example. Another example would be with the names of the organization of the military. They substituted clan names for the various organization of the military. So, you know, they would start with the Marine Corps, right, the top thing, and then it's divided between, or below that, it's divided into... You know, battalion, division, battalion, regiment, platoon, squad, you know, so it goes down to the smaller units. And they named them all after clans. So that was another example of substituting one thing for another. And to them, that made sense. Because in the Navajo mind, in the Diné mind, you belong to your clan. You are a member of your clan. And so they saw the Marine Corps in the same way. There is the Marine Corps. So that was called Diné, which means it refers to the people, but it's more than, it's like all of the people. It's like the tribe in a sense. And then all of the other groups below that were given a clan name. And they chose names, obviously, from the men that were putting the code together. But to them, that made sense because you belong to your clan. So, you know, you have to think about it in the way that a Navajo would think about it sometimes when you're looking at the code.
It's interesting to me that requires a really developed sense of trust, right? Because if I am the person telling the code talker, say this. Of course, I don't know what the code, I mean, I don't know they're doing it right. Right. And it just seems to me that, that there is a really strong bond between the people that are asking to communicate these codes and the people that are actually communicating them.
Yeah. You know, they took a lot of faith on the Marine Corps side. And when you look at the documentation, there's one document that I came across. I can't remember. I think it was probably in 1943 where the commanding officer referred to it as Indian gibberish. He didn't have any faith in the Indian gibberish. But for the most part, they were like, you know, they would try them out in the field and the messages would come back accurate. Things, you know, were working. And so you look at Marine Corps document after Marine Corps document during World War II, and 95% of them are, this is great, this is wonderful. And actually the Marine Corps in 1943, specifically 1943 and also in 1945, they specifically asked for comments back from the field. You know, how is this working? Are the code targets working? Do you want more? And over again, it was always yes. They would give examples of how, you know, just the operation at Peleliu, we used X number of code talkers and it was successful and blah, blah, blah. We want more code talkers. We're going to divide them in this way. So it's interesting to follow the trail and the paper trail because you see that the Marine Corps definitely had a lot of faith in these men.
And the Japanese never broke it.
No.
They tried.
They tried.
They tried, but they weren't able to do it.
No.
I think that, and so this it would seem to me that the 29 guys who had never been in combat, who developed this code, then get into combat and realize probably we need other words. We, you know, now that we're in the real thing, we need to figure out more terms. And so the code evolves from what originally those 29 gentlemen do, right?
Correct, yes. And of course, you know, they were working under the Marine Corps communications. So they had cryptographers, you know, that were monitoring all of this as well. So what happened initially when the first code was created, I think that first list of words that they gave them was basically, it was a test, right? They could have failed. And if those men had failed in creating a viable code, very likely the Marine Corps would have just scrapped the idea and moved on. But there was something there, and it worked. And so once that test happened, the first group of men were sent overseas. They were divided between the 1st and 2nd Marine Divisions. And we know of two for sure in popular narrative that their names have always come up. But I have also discovered that there was probably two more of the first group that were kept stateside to become instructors. And so they, I feel, are the ones that probably added the new terms. So right after they left, we do know that there was a cryptographer, American cryptographer in the communications that approached the program and said, you know, we need to add more words. So they immediately added 200 more words as well as additional terms for some of the letters of the alphabet, particularly the vowels and then commonly used consonants as well. So that way, you know, when you're a cryptographer, you're listening to a code, especially an alphabetical code, if you hear those repetitions, you know, double T's, double L's, or vowels, you can tell, you know, the pattern in English, and so that it makes it easier to break codes. So they were concerned about that. So they asked the code talkers to definitely come up with terms for commonly used consonants and vowels.
I would imagine that the code talkers were ones not to get caught.
They definitely protected their code talkers. You know, the big story, Wind Talkers, that came out, the big movie in 2002, I believe, that was kind of the premise of the whole movie. There were code talkers that claimed that they had bodyguards. But when I was growing up, the story was they were given bodyguards not because it was some top decision from the top down. It was more on a commanding officer's decision in the field on a one-to-one basis kind of situation. Because the code talkers that claimed they had bodyguards all told a similar story. And that was that at some point they were captured, quote unquote, by U.S. Army men. Because the Army would often come in like during the mop-ups and they would bring in supplies to the Marine Corps. And so many of them had stories of, you know, the Marines would just go down to the beach, you know, and just rummage through whatever the Army was dropping off. And so when Navajos were down there, they didn't know who these guys were. And so many of them had M1 stuck in their back and taken in with other prisoners.
Because they thought they were Japanese?
Yeah. Some even have stories of being put in a pen with Japanese prisoners. And, you know, luckily they were all – we don't know of any code talkers that were lost in that fashion.
Were there many lost in combat?
There were a total, I believe, of 11. I think it was seven died – or seven were killed in action and three, I believe, died of wounds.
Fascinating. Let's take a – this is a good time, I think, to take our next break. So the next song I want to play is one you chose called Navajo Code Talkers by an artist named Benny Shea. Do you have any thoughts on this song before we play it?
I hear it a lot, on Instagram and Facebook, and he's recorded it. He's a traditional Navajo singer, and I just love it because it's kind of very haunting, and it's a beautiful song. Yeah.
Okay. This is Navajo Code Talkers by Benny Shea.
Co-talkers done a lenny gay,
Shabbat, Shabbat, Adina said, wait, Shabbat, Shabbat, Adeno said, wait,
That was Navajo Code Talkers by Benny Shea. You are listening to the Apex Radio Hour here on KSUU Thunder 91.1. I'll turn it back to you, Ryan.
Okay, thanks, Faith. So you mentioned that the Navajo Code is declassified in 1968. So are they using Navajo Code Talkers in Korea or Vietnam or anything like that?
That's a good question. When I was growing up, you know, the Code Talkers were getting beginning to get a lot of publicity, and the Marine Corps would always invite them out to various things, and we would make trips with the Code, you know, families would travel with the Code Talkers on a lot of these trips. So we went to D.C. a lot and California to the Camp Pendleton, and, you know, of course, the Marine brass would always talk to the Code Talkers, and the story at that time was that, you know, it's okay for you guys to talk about it. You know, it's declassified. You know, so go ahead and talk about it. Navajo Code hasn't been used since World War II. That's what they would say. Well, you know, over the years as I was doing research, there was a sculpture, a huge outdoor sculpture that was done in Phoenix, that was established in Phoenix. And it was dedicated to the Code Talkers. And so there was a big ceremony. And the commandant, I think it was Commandant Gray at the time, was there. And he did a speech. And in the speech, which was written into a newspaper article, which was very interesting, he said The Navajo code talkers in World War II were told not to talk about what they had done because it remained secret after the war. But the code was used following World War II in Korea and Vietnam, or the technique was the technique continued to be used in Korea and Vietnam. And that's what the quote was. Well, you know, newspapers, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't. But it was interesting and it intrigued me. I have not been able to find any concrete evidence that it was used in Korea and Vietnam, but there is a lot of stories from men who served in those wars. And actually, there was one time we had one of our tribal presidents during his inauguration had the top Veterans Administration guy from D.C. there, and he actually said the same thing. Navajo code talkers, World War II, you know, he talked about them, and then he said, and they went on to be used in Korea and Vietnam. So, you know, it's like, well, where do you guys get this? You're saying it, but there's no evidence. So who knows? Maybe, you know, that might, if I don't come across it, a future historian will maybe find a cache of documents that'll
tell us the story.
Exactly.
So this, you know, it's interesting when you think about, and again, I'm just hypothesizing here, but the treatment of the code talkers seems to be fairly positive, right? In the units and history has treated them as heroes, as they obviously are, as veterans who fight. But then you compare that with other Native Americans that served not as code talkers. I mean, the very famous Ira Hayes and others who really suffer for this. I mean, it's interesting to me that you have a population that had been treated so poorly by the average Americans that yet then do this amazing work to help save people who otherwise would think down on them. I mean, you mentioned the fire water in the canteens and all these other typical, stereotypical images of Native Americans. Right. And it's interesting that they do this.
Well, yeah, there's two separate things there. So let me kind of comment on both. Yes, you know, the Navajo code talkers have become this iconic image, right, of Native American military servicemen. And yes, they deserve for what they did was pretty unique. And it definitely helped. You ask any Marine. And I mean, I've seen Marines as high as the commandant come to tears talking about the Marine, the code talkers. So they are very highly respected in the Marine Corps. So during the war, they were especially in the Marine Corps. I mean, you know, there's different the branches of the service are very different in very very many ways. And again, you know, I am a little biased, but in the Marine Corps, and I think in any military, you know, they put you through training, and you become a United States Marine, or you become a member of the U.S. Army, or whatever. So you learn this new, you become part of a new culture. And I've had a lot of veterans tell me that, or Native veterans, that especially with the Marine Corps, that they connected with that because it was very similar to being part of their own tribe. They had a lot of the same kinds of culture, in a sense. So that's one aspect of it. But during World War II, you know, I call it an ignorant prejudice. So Native people experienced prejudice at that time, obviously, both in and out of the service. But to me, it was this kind of naive or ignorant prejudice where it was still wrapped around stereotypes. And so they would get called chief, right, in the service. And for years after after the 70s, 80s, after the story came out, we would have Marine Corps veterans that would come to the service, to the reservation, and they wanted to find the code talkers that they had served with. And some of them knew their names, but occasionally you would have, oh man, I'm looking for the code talkers I served with, but I don't remember his name. I think it was Yazzie, but you know, there's like a million Yazzies. But I remember we called him Chief. You know, so there were those kinds of things. But like I said, it was kind of this ignorant prejudice where they were emulated. Because for Navajo people, I remember some of the code talkers talking about that term chief. And for them, it was very uncomfortable to be called chief because, first of all, chief is not part of our vocabulary. We call our traditional leaders headmen or Natani. And so they didn't feel comfortable being put in this position where they were seen as these higher ups because they weren't. But for the other Marines, to them, it was a sign of respect. It was a sign of, you know, just something that they could emulate the men. So, you know, that it was a different kind of prejudice that they experienced. Now, you mentioned Ira Hayes. You know, Ira Hayes, like many veterans, you know, especially if you're a combat veteran, it's tough. And usually they're the ones that don't talk about their experiences when they come back. And it's for obvious reasons. You know, I remember my dad, for example, when I was a kid, I loved to go to the 4th of July fireworks. And my dad would not go. My mom would have to take me, or I'd have to go with my uncles or something. And I never knew why. I thought, you know, why doesn't my dad want to go with me? You know, I took it personally. But come to find out, you know, years later, I realized when he told me, he says, you know, I just can't. It reminds me of PTSD. It would cause PTSD. And I think that's so ironic that we do that in this country. You know, we expect our men to go off, men and women to go off to war, and then we do these big celebrations with fireworks that just re-traumatizes them over and over again. I mean, to me, that's like schizophrenic. Uh-huh. It's a little crazy. Or that my father would also not, at nighttime, he wouldn't let me or my mom, he would want the curtains closed. He didn't want windows open. So, you know, they all experienced this to various degrees. And that was the thing with Ira Hayes. You know, he unfortunately got pulled into that group that they brought back for the big public, you know, displays of wanting to raise money and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the Code Talkers were just as affected. There were a lot of them that came back. There were some of them that, you know, the war got to them and they committed suicide, a few of them. There's several that turned to alcohol like a lot of veterans do. You know, it's just part of the culture that we, I think, as Americans really need to understand. And the one thing I'd like to mention that, you know, for Navajo people, and I'm sure other tribes do too, when a veteran comes back from the war, they have ceremonies done to rid them of, you know, kind of psychologically and spiritually rid them of the war. But it's a family, it's a social event that happens. And so they're brought back into the community and they're respected and they're honored. And we don't do that in America. You know, it's different from just saying thank you to a veteran. And I think, you know, if there was some way, if we're going to continue doing this, it's something that really needs to be something to learn from Native people. You know, bring them back into the community and respect them for what they did, because that's a tremendous sacrifice that they make, whether they come home or don't. It's a tremendous sacrifice.
That's a beautiful thought. Let's stop and take a break there, and then we'll come back with our last segment. So the next song that you have selected for us is one called Code Talker Song by Talaba Begay. Do you have any reference to that particular song of why you chose it for us?
Again, it's out there, and you know, I really like her. She does a lot of music. I think she's got it's on Instagram. If you can Google her, you know, get her on Instagram, and she does a lot with her grandma. And they sing together, and so she's just a really great person, and I like her music.
All right. So this is Code Talker Song by Talaba Begay.
Don't let go.
That was Code Talker Song by Taliba Begay. You are listening to the Apex Radio Hour here on KSUU, Thunder 91.1. I'll turn it back to you, Ryan.
Thank you, Faith. I have enjoyed our conversation, and I'm excited to see your work. Dr. Gorman, we'll start that now. As you said, you're dissertating. You're almost done, but we'll go ahead and credit you that way. So I'm excited to see. And you have a book that'll be coming out. Is that correct?
I hope so. I mean, you know, I'm working on my dissertation. I'm getting my PhD in history from the University of New Mexico. And it's been a long journey, but I'm finally, you know, at the end here. I'll be graduating in May. And yeah, I would like to take that dissertation and turn it into a book.
Oh, well, that would be super cool and exciting. So this is our final segment, and we do this with every guest, and it's a pretty simple question. Sometimes it's a little more complex to answer, but we're going to start with you. So Zani Gorman, what are you currently watching, reading, listening to, or playing that is bringing you joy?
That's interesting. I forgot you were going to ask me that question. Yeah. Well, as we just said, I'm dissertating, and you know how a lot of people, grad students, always got the headphones on listening to stuff when you're working, right? I cannot work to somebody singing. If anybody's talking, singing, I can't work. I read the same sentence over and over and over again. Amazingly and interestingly, what I listen to is Mozart. I love Mozart, and that's my zone. That's where I just get into writing. Is with Mozart.
So Mozart.
Mozart, yes.
Yeah, that makes that makes a lot of sense now that works. So Faith Christensen, what are you currently watching, reading, listening to, or playing that is bringing you joy?
Well, this Sunday I was able to listen to a few of religious leaders in my faith, and honestly, a lot of it was really eye-opening of some practices that I do right now. So one thing that I've fallen into the habit of is scrolling on my phone when there's times of just boredom or buffering or taking a break, quote-unquote break, from studying or doing my homework or doing work in general. And it was interesting to learn more about, like, hey, let's, you know, not put so much power in your device. And so I personally really needed to hear that as, yeah, I want to do things a little more productive than watch some guy make a lot of things out of chocolate. If you know those videos, you know what I'm talking about. But other than that, it's been really good. So, Ryan Paul, what are you currently watching, reading, listening to, or playing that is bringing you joy?
Well, mine isn't as cultured as Mozart or as spiritually relevant is not wasting time with my phone. But it is this. I have gone back to my roots as a young man. Back in the 80s, I was a big reader of science fiction and fantasy works. You know, I played D&D as a kid and those kinds of things. And I was a member of the Science Fiction Book Club. I don't know if you remember this or not, but you should get those in the mail, and you get like 5 books, and you had to buy one every, you know, they sent a subscription or whatever. And I remembered end up subscribing multiple times because I'd lose books or whatever. But I've got back into reading some fantasy. As Dr. Gorman will tell you, when you do the work that we do, you spend a lot of time reading a lot of nonfiction and history, which can be as compelling, if not more so, than fiction. But I thought I'm going to take some a little bit of breaks, read work at work, and read some stuff at home. So I am currently reading a book called Theft of Swords by Michael Sullivan, and it is originally self-published in 2 separate books, and they combined it into this one volume. And I got to tell you, I'm pretty happy. I mean, it's been a long time since I've sat on my couch or in my chair and just read a fiction book like that was of a fantasy nature. So, Theft of Swords is what is bringing me joy. And with that, we want to thank Dr. Zani Gorman. I want to thank you, Faith, for being here and guiding us along this process. And we're going to go out with the last song that you gave us. This song is called Navajo Code Talkers, and it's by Vincent Craig, who you have told us was the son of a Navajo Code Talker, if I remember. So can you tell us a little about this song?
Yes, this song is one of my favorites. So when the Navajo Code Talkers received their first national recognition in 1981, I believe, might have been 82. I'm tired. Vincent is the son of a Code Talker, and he passed away several years ago, unfortunately. But he was a comedian and songwriter and musician, and he was beloved among the Navajo people, and he'd do concerts all over the place. But he recorded this song when they received their first national honors in 1981, I believe. And my memory of it is the mailman knocking on my mom and dad's door, and I was there that particular day. And my mom was handed a package, and she opened it, and it was the little 45 records. It was a 45 cut of this song. And so we all wanted to listen to it, so she put it on the record player, and we started listening to it. And you've got to listen to the whole song. It's just very, very beautiful. I cry every time I hear it. And right after we started playing it, the phone rang, and my mom answered the phone. And later she told me when she sat down, because she immediately after the phone call was over, she came and she just sat down and she burst into tears. And so later she told me, she said that was Senator from Arizona that had just called, his office had called, because Arizona was the one that had pushed this the first time. And they asked her, they said, "Are you sitting down, Mary?" And she said, "No." They said, "Well, you better sit down." So she sat down, and they said, "The House and the Senate have just passed recognition for the Navajo Code Talkers." And so it happened the following year in 1982 that they received their honors. So it was just weird to have that song playing when that phone call came through.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you, Dr. Gorman, for being here. And this is Navajo Code Talkers by Vincent Craig.
He's the son of the four directions and the child of the blessing way. Raised in the loving arms of his mother's humanity, wisdom comes to him through the legends of long ago, told by a man who loved the wandering eyes of a little child. My daddy was a Code Talker man, with Uncle Sam's Marines. He spoke on the whistling wind during the time of man's inhumanity. Train headed to LA, off to fight a war that he really couldn't understand. Goodbye to the four sacred mountains of his youth, but he shall return for the medicine bag is strong. Remember me, my four sacred mountains. Help me to understand the pain that he suffered then, during the time of man's inhumanity. South Pacific, a place called Iwo Jima. Destiny had brought him here. Many of you will die. Oh, that's what they told him then. Perhaps he thought of home and his people, the Navajo. Remember me, my four sacred mountains. Help me to understand the pain that he suffered then, during the time of man's inhumanity. During the time